Hi, I'm James Schillinglaw, and I'm here with Sven Lindblad, who is the now the CEO and soon to be co-chair of Lindblad Expeditions. And we're here to talk about expedition cruising and what Lindblad is doing. And I think Sven is really the dean of expedition cruising right now in the market. He has been doing it for a long time now, and his company is a great one and has really been a pioneer in the category. So you're going to find out about all that and more on Insider Travel Report. First of all, we were talking earlier, how are you and where are you?
I'm very well. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina, trying to walk down the streets without bumping into a million tourists and heading back to New York next week.
No, that's great. Although I don't think Charleston is quite one of your expedition cruise destinations, at least not yet, but we'll see what happens.
Well, to be honest, Charleston, when the pandemic hit last March, we closed our office. I came down to Charleston for 4 months because my wife has family here. And we have been exploring all around this area and the waterways around Charleston and heading down to Georgia and it's just incredible. Really, really, really beautiful. And in fact, we're going to develop some ideas here.
There you go.
Expedition
cruising in Charleston, South Carolina. Now that's a first. I don't think anybody will be else down there, but it sounds like a great idea. I agree with you. I think it's a wonderful destination. But now let's talk a little bit about, Lindblad Expeditions just announced that you'll be sort of stepping down as CEO and the operational part and becoming co-chair of the board, and you'll be succeeded by a guy named Dolph Burrell, effective May 10th. So when this sees the light of day, you'll still be CEO. Why are you doing this at this time, and what will your new role be?
Yeah, so the timing is kind of interesting, and it sounds precipitous on the surface, but it's not at all. I approached the board a couple of years ago, and I said, look, I think I really would like us to find a CEO.
Right.
I've been doing this for 40 years. It's on a day-to-day basis. It's really all-consuming.
Right.
And I'm very keen on focusing on some specific things that I really don't have enough time to focus on at the moment. So many aspects of business development. We have acquired several companies. There's several more we want to look at, and we want to do a lot organically. And those are all, to really vet those ideas and to really spend time being focused on them. It takes a lot of work. And, when you're CEO, you have a day job as well that is very consuming. So I'm really, really happy. It took us 2 years. We found this great guy, Dolph Burrell. Burley is the pronunciation, even though it's spelled Burrell.
So I can't say Milton. It's not Milton Burrell. It's Burley. Okay.
Well, Burley, yeah. And I've spent some, I've spent a lot of time with him on the phone. A couple of weeks ago, I spent several days with him in Sun Valley, Idaho. And he's going to be a great, great leader of this company.
No, that's great. So this was the right time for you to sort of take on this new role, both from your perspective and the company's.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Lindblad, let's turn to another thing. Lindblad Expeditions just said it would be resuming travel to Alaska starting in June. Why are you doing this now? And how are you able to do this? Just remind everybody, because your ships can sail in Alaska, right?
Yes. Well, in order to reactivate, you really need three things. You need a good medical solution, which we have. You need a welcome mat from the place you want to go. In the case of Alaska, we have. And you need the willingness and the interest on the part of travelers, which we also have. So, and this year, you need U.S. flagged ships,
right,
which we have four. So Alaska is a very logical place for us to start first in terms of reactivation. And we're really, really excited about it because, that time it'll have been 15 months that these ships will have been dormant, which is a long time for ships to be dormant. So we're very excited to get reactivated again.
Now, those ships you're going to be using, I believe, National Geographic Quest and National Geographic Venture, right? And what itineraries will they offer?
Yeah, we're going to start with those two. And those are one-week itineraries in Southeast Alaska between Juneau and Sitka. Juneau, the starting point, Sitka, the ending point, or vice versa. And then in between, really, entirely in the wild. You know, Alaska is a place that we know very, very well. We've been there every summer since 1981. This is an area that that we probably know every nook and cranny of. And even when you have large cruise ships there, even in normal times, we can go for a whole week and we don't see any of these ships because they rely on ports where we rely on or seek out the wild. But this year is going to be an interesting year. And I don't know how, nobody really knows how this is going to manifest itself. But literally, you know, there's going to be very, very few ships there.
Yeah.
And none of them are going to be big because of obviously the inability of foreign flagships to use Canada as a point in the itinerary at some point in order to comply with the Jones Act. So it's going to be interesting to see. Will anything be behaving differently as a consequence?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. You're going to sail out of Juneau or where?
Juneau and Sitka.
And Sitka. Okay. Yeah. Well, you'll be seeing my friend Captain Dan Blanchard up there at Uncruise.
Yeah. We've had a lot of conversation with Dan during this time. You know, coordinating them in terms of protocols and such. You know, because we're all in this together, and in any way, if there's any way any of us can help each other get back into business in a responsible way, that's a good thing.
No, absolutely. And we'll hopefully have a great season. Although, as you said, it's going to be a pretty empty season, which is a good thing because none of the big ships will be going up there. I can't see them any way they can get ready and up in time, even if they get some kind of dispensation, which increasingly looks less likely either from Canada or from the U.S. Congress. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. But of course, you know, from the perspective of, and you know, obviously there are always winners and losers in every sort of decision. But for a lot of Alaskans, the fact that the big cruise ships aren't there is really unfortunate because they represent value to their livelihood. So at the end of the day, I just hope we can get to a point where the people of Alaska have a level of tourism that is helpful to their aspirations, of which we are a small part. But
yeah, we all hope, and I know it has had a pretty bad impact. Now, another place which has really suffered during this period, and it's another place you're going to be starting up as well, is you're going to be resuming cruises in the Galapagos starting June 4 on National Geographic Endeavour 2. What itineraries will you offer there?
So there we have... Actually, this is true in Alaska as well, just to go back to that for a second. So we have these one-week itineraries, and then we have these shorter itineraries on the Sea Lion, on one of our smaller ships, that are called Alaska Escapes, Wild Alaska Escapes. They're five-night voyages, because we've discovered there are these different sort of audiences that have different amounts of time that they're willing to devote. So we're trying to develop these shorter opportunities everywhere in the world that we operate, or in most places that we operate. In the case of Galapagos, though, we won't be doing that for the time being, because it also involves a lot of land components, and we're somewhat more restricted as it relates to that for the time being. So our voyages will be our traditional one-week voyage in the islands themselves. So each voyage just goes for a week, visiting all kinds of different places in the Galapagos archipelago.
Well, as people who have been watching Insider Travel Report know, I had my first experience in the Galapagos this year with one of your fellow operators, Metropolitan Touring, which was eye opener for me. I only got a taste of it. So, and they have been operating down there, and you know the Galapagos needs a few more ships to get in there. We saw some of the other ships that were just sitting there, not really operating. So it's great that you're going to be back.
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about a place like the Galapagos is really opened up all of our eyes, which is pretty much over 80% of livelihoods in the Galapagos Islands are dependent on tourism.
Right.
And obviously, when you have a situation like this, that becomes pretty catastrophic. And you know, what we should be thinking about now is that's too high a number. There has to be greater diversity because you can't have an entire community of people, an entire economy collapse over the disappearance of a single industry.
Right.
That's really not a good equation. So we're looking forward to getting back to the Galapagos. from the perspective of our business, obviously, from the perspective of, you know, guests wanting to get out there and traveling again. But as importantly, if not more importantly, for the sake of the people of the Galapagos Islands that really, really need this to be reactivated.
And indeed, I believe we've interviewed your team, and you set up a fund for the Galapagos people as well to kind of, you know, get them through this, if I recall, which is really
Well, it was an idea that came up from one of our staff members in Ecuador, and the idea is to create a $500,000 minimum. That's what our goal is. A pool of capital to disperse in terms of microloans. We've already dispersed a couple of dozen of them, ranging from agricultural ideas to ideas in tourism, in terms of sustainable fisheries. One is a sort of a craft beer company using local fruits. And so I'm really excited about this because that will stay way beyond the pandemic, because those monies will be repaid and they'll be recirculated, and we will keep adding to that pool and growing that pool. And now we're having conversation next week with some folks about how we can structure this so that we can learn from this and then apply it to different parts of the world. Because I think if you can loan money at very favorable rates, obviously, and favorable terms, that's a better idea than giving people money, because it continually recirculates. So we're very, very excited.
It was a great one. I heard about it. I thought it was a great idea. And having been there and seeing, you know, how many people do depend on travel and tourism down there for now, it really is necessary until we can get some back. And as you said, maybe they have to start diversifying a little bit and figure out other sources of income. So, you know, if this happens again, God forbid, you know, that they won't be as dependent. But
I just want to leave this quickly. When you think about it, James, and you know this as well, if not better than anybody, you know, tourism being such a huge industry on a global basis, and you know, arguably the largest business in the world, if you aggregate it in all of its parts. And the world has a lot of challenges simultaneously, right? So we have an opportunity in this business to really get creative around how do we become more meaningful in different places we visit? How do we engage our guests more, you know, in better ways so that we can add greater value to the places we visit and be a support structure that really is a meaningful one that goes beyond just what governments can do? We have an opportunity. We can marshal that creativity. Certainly the resources ought to be there, because it's such a huge, huge, huge business. And it wouldn't take all that much to make a meaningful difference in the world.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about sort of for these cruises that you're starting in Alaska, restarting, I guess, in Alaska and Galapagos. I assume you've implemented all the health and safety protocols to make sure it's safe for your guests to cruise with Lindblad on these itineraries.
Yeah, you know, we've had a team joined at the hip for the last year focusing on, you know, protocols. And we have a consulting physician who's sort of the head of that group. And interacting very closely with outside organizations, University of Alaska, the CDC, all kinds of external groups, to really, and this has been shifting since. You know, we started with sort of protocols related with testing. We put those ideas forward. That there were lots of challenges in the early stages as it relates to that. Obviously, the acceleration of vaccinations. You're getting your second vaccination tomorrow. I'm getting my second one today. Pretty much everybody in our demographic will have been vaccinated by June, right, or have had the opportunity, not necessarily be vaccinated, but have the opportunity to be vaccinated. And so we have now said, okay, we're requiring our guests to be vaccinated.
Right.
And that's for the sake of our guests, who through a survey have said very, very clearly that they would prefer to travel with fellow guests that have been vaccinated. It's good for our crew, and it's certainly good for the places that we intend to go. So vaccinations now are the thing. We're getting a little pushback from a few people, but that's honestly irrelevant.
No, and I've seen that too. I mean, increasingly numbers of cruise lines are going this route, and it looks like, I mean, even on the mass market, the contemporary market, Norwegian is the first to really put that in, or, you know, and they want to say, well, we want to start July 4th and everybody will get vaccinated. But the smaller lines, the expedition cruise lines, the luxury lines have already started doing that. So it's, I think that's the way it's going to go.
It has to. It's irrational to be against that. Yeah. For anyone who's against that, it's just irrational.
Well, you and I both have had those comments, you know, that, you know, it's like, what if you can't get vaccinated? But it's like, or you don't want to, you know, so it's.
You got to protect the overall organism. And if somebody doesn't want to, it's sad they can't, you know, be involved, but they can do other things.
Absolutely. Now this time with the pandemic, it sort of would appear to be a time to take stock in the expedition cruise business and where it's at today. Is this sort of one of the safest and most desirable forms of travel, you think, today because of the situation?
Well, I certainly as it relates to COVID, I would say that smaller numbers work in your favor.
Right.
You have more control. You have more transparency meaning that you're sort of running into each other all the time. So to me, there are a lot of advantages of being a smaller ship, right, or a smaller group, period. I mean, obviously the CDC has said that they don't like gatherings more than X. So there are reasons for that. There's a presumption, and I think it's a fair one, that that smaller units have less likelihood of being winding up being problematic. So I do think that expedition cruises are a particularly safe way to travel, particularly with the kind of protocols we're putting in place, and other companies as well. So, you know, I think the odds of contracting COVID, particularly when you're vaccinated, which means even if you do contract it, the likelihood of it being serious is extremely minimal. So I think we're getting to the point where, you know, traveling with us to Alaska, for example, probably is safer than crossing the street. So,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So,
no, absolutely. And I totally agree with you. I think any cruise, to be honest with you, is probably safer than crossing the street. But unfortunately, you know, it at the beginning of all this pandemic, it got a lot of bad publicity. But yeah, let's talk a little from your perspective. This is the big question. As sort of the dean of expedition cruising, you know, how has expedition cruising evolved since you began offering such cruises way back when? What was it like when you started, and what's different today?
Yeah, so when, you know, I was talking with some friends about being in Antarctica back in the early 70s, and of course in those days we were the only people there, and then eventually one other company started, and then it was a long time before anybody else sort of came down there. And you know, that was cool. I mean, you know, there's no question being pretty much everywhere we were right, pretty much on our own. And there was a certain excitement and thrill to that, obviously, discovering new places where no man had gone before, in essence, except explorers and missionaries and scientists. But I think really, to be honest, I think now is the greatest era ever for exploration. Right. Because first of all, a person who travels with us now to Antarctica, and I'm just using Antarctica as an example, sure, because it was back then the most, you know, challenging and remote place. I spent in the Antarctic, I almost got killed twice. Right. And I almost killed a bunch of other people, on a couple of occasions. So, because we just didn't know any better.
Right.
You know, we were out there, we were trying to find, I remember going inside a glacier with a Zodiac full of people, because I was following a guy who was one of my mentors.
Right.
A guy called Keith Shackleton, the nephew of Ernest.
Yeah, we've heard of that name, yeah.
Yeah. And looking up and say, wow, this is so cool. You would never do that now. It's one of the most dangerous things you could possibly do. So, and there were several such things we used to do because we didn't know any better. Now we know a lot. And right, think about it. We've been there for since when my father first took people there in 1966. That's a long time, right? And that cumulative accumulation of knowledge is substantive, which means we can stretch now. We can do things responsibly that we would have perhaps done before irresponsibly, or not irresponsibly. We were not irresponsible. We were just like just not as knowledgeable. So I think people now actually have the possibility for a more interesting expedition. We have kayaks aboard our ship, right, now, which we use. It took us 2 years to develop that idea so that we could do it safely and responsibly. We have all kinds of underwater technology. We have navigational equipment, and our new ships are PC-5 rated, which means they can go way, way deeper into the ice and further afield. So anyone who thinks that the experience is diminished now is just basically wrong. Right. I believe the experience can be way, way greater now. The thing that I do lament somewhat is, perhaps too many people in it too fast, some of which will not have had the experience, will have to get it. Perhaps some not so good things will happen along the way. And at the end of the day, there is no substitute for experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now every we'll talk a little bit about the influx of companies getting into the market. But almost every one of them says, our experienced expedition team. And there's been a lot more Antarctic experienced teams than we even knew existed before. So
they were all hiding in caves and waiting for somebody to liberate them give them a little potion so that they could come out and start expedition cruising.
Well, let's talk also about this. We started, expedition cruising started to be all about Antarctica when you started. And now it's going to the Galapagos. It's going to Alaska. It's going on the Northwest Passage, the Northeast Passage, exotic islands. How much more can expedition cruising, add destinations and experience? Or is this sort of limitless?
Well, the reality is that, when you say it was all Antarctica in the beginning, not really. Like when my father built his ship, the first purpose-built expedition ship, the Lindblad Explorer, in 1969.
Right.
You had 3 months or 3.5 months you could be in Antarctica, but then you had the rest of the time where you had to find other destinations. So even back then, it was the Seychelles, it was ultimately the Arctic, it was going across the Pacific. All those areas were harder to get people to be quite as interested. It was going up the Amazon. You went 2,000 miles up Amazon with the Explorer. So you had to, if you're going to have a ship, you have to occupy it. And if you have to occupy it, you obviously have to find new geography, which, by the way, is one of the things I'm going to be focusing on in my semi-retirement, which is building out new geographies. But now it's not like you're discovering great swaths of territory. Now it's nuances.
Right.
Now it's real deep curation, because you can't just throw out an idea and say, we're going to go from here to there and hope that people, you have to really, really look at the details. And again, to me, in many ways, that's even more exciting, because when you really, really focus on that, you can really find ways to provide people with extraordinary experiences. So it isn't just, we're going to go diving in that part of the world. You may spend a month trying to figure out where are the three dive spots that we incorporate in this particular itinerary that are really represent the greatest, that are the greatest representations of diving in that area, right? So there is nothing to substitute for research and development.
No, absolutely. And it sounds like that's going to be a major part of your new role, is to be a pioneer and figure out where to go next and how to do it, more importantly, because, Now let's talk a little bit about, the past few years, at least the last two or three, more players have entered the expedition cruising market than I've ever seen, especially sort of luxury cruise lines, that sort of do luxury expedition. Why do you think this has happened? And why in general has expedition cruising become so popular?
Yeah, it's there are two different parts of that question that are kind of interesting. I one of the reasons that people are getting into it is financial, right? I mean, the rates that expedition cruise lines get compared to traditional cruising are vastly different, and so it on paper it seems like a really good idea. I think us going public probably had something to do with it, because all of a sudden our information was out there. Prior to that, there was no information that was accessible in relationship to expedition cruising. So and I kind of lament that in some way, that all that information was out there and that perhaps was partially responsible for this acceleration. But I do think there are factors in the world that contribute to people's interest in expedition cruising. I think people, for example, are really becoming more and more conscious of the fact that the northern and southern climes, the Arctic and the Antarctic, are changing dramatically.
Right.
I do think people are much more aware of what are the implications of global warming. I do think people are cognizant of the fact that wildlife is under threat. And so all of a sudden, the urgency that people have to want to go to these places, I think, is accelerated. There are a lot more people with disposable income. People are healthier now at older ages than they were before. So there are lots of things conspiring positively to get people more interested in these kinds of activities. People don't want to just sit on a beach and get suntan because they know that will likely kill them
right.
at some point.
Yeah, that's
right. As a consequence of skin cancer. So, you know, and then there's just so many factors out there. But I now rarely meet somebody that doesn't want to go out and explore the world in some fashion. And every time I meet somebody and they hear that I'm in this business, they immediately start peppering me with questions about, you know, really meaningful questions and showing great curiosity about what the possibilities are for them to travel.
Well, no, and absolutely. And these, you are in the bucket list business kind of that, you know, you're doing things that everybody dreams of doing. But you mentioned something earlier about, you know, sustainable tourism and obviously you've been at the forefront there. But as we emerge from the pandemic, many in the industry believe we really should refocus or reemerge really focused on sustainable tourism and kind of build a business that is much more eco-sensitive. First of all, do you agree with that? And also, how has Lindblad Expeditions evolved sustainable tourism?
Well, so I've always believed, because again, I came to this business not as a trained travel business person.
Right.
I came to it. I had spent seven years in East Africa. I came and I worked for my father for a short period of time, and then I started building this business. So, to me, the intersection between travel and building reverence, building interest, building concern in the natural environment has always gone hand in hand. I can't see one without the other. So, my fundamental philosophical belief is I need to be very successful at my business. Because if I'm successful at my business, I will be able to perpetuate or have greater relevance in what I really care about, which is our relationship to the environment.
Sure.
And to the communities that are dependent on the environment. And to me, I get very, very excited with, I'll get reasonably happy when our numbers are better. And I think that's important. And I got, you know, I've got a team focused on that. And we do that very, very well. But when we launch something like this, Galapagos Relief Fund, for example, or that we see that another, several thousand square kilometer marine reserve is created in part because of the support we gave the team that was working on that, or where we can see a school thriving in the Galapagos Islands that's going to create the future leadership in that place, that gives me tremendous satisfaction. And it gives our employees tremendous satisfaction. And it gives our guests tremendous satisfaction. Sure. They're part of that. And I believe that all science will tell you the thing that makes us happiest in life is when we can give to something we care about, that where we can, and it doesn't necessarily have to be money, it can be anything, but that's what makes us happy, when we can make other people's lives, other circumstances better. It eclipses all material goods. All science will tell you that. So as we are in a people business, right, all of us that are in this business,
right,
if we really try and say, hey, where are the opportunities where we can help other people or other circumstances, that will be meaningful and it will make us a hell of a lot happier.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I would think so. Now, talk a little bit about what the target market is now for expedition cruising. Who are your customers today, and how does that compare to what a market was in the past, and what it would be in the future, I think?
Well, I think it's way more diverse. I mean, pre-9/11, I pretty much look at 9/11 as having been a pivotal point
right.
where the demographics completely changed. Prior to that, it was mostly couples, 90%, and then some widows and widowers.
Right.
And that was basically a trickling of families. Post 9/11, people wanted to start traveling more with their friends. Family travel exploded. I mean, you know, for us in the summer, family travel is just to Alaska and Galapagos is huge. You know, it's like 80% of everyone there has a kid involved in one form or another. Very often, by the way, instituted by or initiated by grandparents. I would build a statue to grandparents. They are the most awesome force for travel. You get just so many, you know, they come in so many different sort of groupings and age groupings too. I mean, it used to be very much older. Now it's very much more diverse. So I think it's been very, very exciting to see this diversity of audience sort of emerge. You know, the only thing I feel somewhat bad about or less sanguine about is the fact that, unfortunately, this has to be quite expensive.
Right.
Or very expensive. And that makes me somewhat uncomfortable at times because I feel that there are a lot of people who cannot access this form of travel right. because of the economics. But there's no way to stay small and to keep it high quality and to have it be inexpensive. That just doesn't work.
No. I know. I realize you. But then, of course, you have all these other players getting in, and they're going to be as expensive as you, if not more. And they seem to have the market. So people are going. Yes, it's not a mass market product, but it clearly is a niche product that is expanding. And more and more people have the wherewithal to do it.
Oh yeah, no question. And I think everybody has a gene within them that makes them want to explore.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's more latent, sometimes it's more overt. He wants to be an explorer. Something within them wants that. So
absolutely.
So I think it's you combine that with health. With a massive amount of wealth having been accumulated in the United States and other parts of the world. I think there's just going to be more and more people wanting to do this.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned, 9/11 was a turning point, a tipping point. Do you think the pandemic will be?
I think the pandemic will absolutely change a lot of how people travel in the future. Although I don't know exactly how yet,
right?
But that's
your job now. You're gonna have to figure that out.
Where they want to go. Yeah, and I think this is gonna be an opportunity to really learn a lot about, you know, what ultimately matters to people. But I do think the wild will benefit because I do think, just generally speaking, the whole notion of being, I think natural distancing is going to be more valuable. I think people are like. Not that they're going to necessarily be fearful, but at the end of the day, there's so much in tourism that involves crowding and lots of people in small space. I think that's going to be somewhat passé in many, many ways.
Right.
So if there's going to be a greater interest in the wild, then I hope that it is accompanied by a greater sense of responsibility about how to be stewards in the wild, because otherwise that will be a disaster.
No, absolutely. Now, the corollary to that question is my next one was, you know, what is the future for expedition cruising and what is the future for a hold for Lindblad expeditions?
Yeah. So, obviously, the idea of going on an expedition and overcrowding do not go together.
Right.
So, we are going to have to figure out how to spread out. So, like, one of the reasons we built at extraordinary expense our latest polar ships as PC5, which is just a higher level of ice class. It's the highest ice class passenger ship ever built, the National Geographic Endurance. The new ship that Ponant is building, the Charcot, will have an even higher ice class, and that will be going to the North Pole, which, by the way, is an interesting idea where there's nothing to see, but nevertheless,
At least you've been there. It's like this thing. I want to go to the North Pole. I mean, you know, I mean, for years it was when I was a kid, I thought I'd see Santa Claus up there, but you know. It's
like, well, he may be there. You don't know. You're not 100% sure. Maybe hiding behind one of those like Bergie bits. But in any case, this allows us to sort of, our inaugural voyage on the National Geographic Endurance was right. going to be to Svalbard, the Norwegian Arctic, in April.
Right.
Based on a reconnaissance trip I had done a couple of years ago in March. When we first started going to that part of the world, we did not go to July because of ice conditions.
Wow.
And then eventually we started later July, and then eventually earlier July, June, May. And I went up there in March, and it was just stunningly beautiful.
Right.
But you have to have a very, very high ice class vessel in order to really move about there responsibly. So, but it's magnificent. And so with these vessels, we can go farther, we can go deeper, we can go earlier, we can stay later. And that takes a bit of pressure off of these places in terms of being too many people at the same time in the same place. In Antarctica, what I do fear is that with a massive increase of activity, there are only so many places you can land where you combine the ability to land and interest. And you cannot be more than 100 people ashore at once, which is a great thing.
Right.
And so those landing sites are going to be, there's going to be more pressure than is ideal on those landing sites. And it is highly likely that people will have to go ashore less often as a consequence.
No, that
to me is really, really unfortunate.
Right.
And so that's why we are going to really, really focus on scouting new areas in the Antarctic where we can go and, again, where we have the capacity to land and there's something of interest. So we can kind of get away from the overcrowding that will absolutely happen on the Antarctic Peninsula.
Yeah, well, it is true. I mean, and even, you know, we're talking about other destinations. Galapagos had a lot more. It was great to be there when there were very few ships, and you're going to experience that in this Alaska season where there's not going to be many ships, you know.
Yeah, but in the Galapagos, I have to say that the national park, so more people are going to the Galapagos now than were going previously, but most of that increase is land-based.
Right.
And most of that increase is Ecuadorian land-based travel. Mm-hmm. In the islands themselves, they're incredibly well regulated. You cannot be more than a certain number of people at a landing site at a particular time, and that's been maintained. So the experience from a traveler's point of view there now, even when all the ships are operating, is really no different than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago.
No, absolutely. Now, my last question really is, and you look back, and what would your father, Lars Erik Lindblad, think about Lindblad expeditions today? What would he think about the state of expedition cruising today?
Well, I think he'd feel pretty good about what we're doing. I think he'd find that pretty exciting. I mean, he pioneered a concept. There's no question that he is the father of ecotourism. There's no question that he's the father of expedition travel, and we have all sort of followed in his footsteps
right.
in one form or another. A lot of his naturalists started other companies, and this, so I think he'd feel pretty proud about that. I think he would probably lament the fact that there's probably going to be a certain amount of activity in this space that is not as thoughtful as it probably should be or could be, and that would bother him a great deal. At the end of the day, his interest was always combining the ability to travel with the ability to learn and the ability to be more relevant in terms of the challenges that we face. He was really I don't know if you ever met him, James, but you know, he really had no interest in the travel business per se,
right.
as a business. His running of a business was a bit of a challenge at times. He wanted to be an explorer,
right?
And he wanted to find ways to make people appreciate nature more, and culture and history. And he was a remarkable, unique individual.
That's what I've heard. I did not have the opportunity, but I've heard a lot of stories. And, you know, we all know all the stories about your dad, and he was a really unique person. Yeah, he may not have been a businessman per se, but he certainly was a pioneer.
He was such a pioneer, and I miss him. Every time I see something extraordinary, he's always sort of in the back of my mind, and I wish he was there. And
Yeah, well, now your new role, you're kind of doing exactly what he would like to do, which is go out and find new places and, you know, explore and bring new experiences to people, as well as get them to better understand sustainable tourism.
Yeah, well, we're fortunate. We have a great team of people, captains, naturalists, people in our office, in our market. And and we all, he's always been this sort of North Star for all of us. And, it's a very exciting business to be in, and it's to me very, very satisfying to know that we are, yes, we do have a successful business, but I think we also have a meaningful business.
Right.
And I feel very good about that.
Well, Sven, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Fascinating stuff. Good luck with your new role. It sounds like something that you're going to be very happy to do. And who wants to do all the number stuff? Geez, I don't want to do that. But the same thing. You know, we want to go out and travel. We want to explore. We want to be the pioneers. And and then leave. The other stuff for the people who like that stuff, the numbers. But I want to thank you for spending some time with us today, and good luck to you and good luck to Lindblad Expeditions.
Thank you very much, James. Always good to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'm James Schillinglaw, and this is Insider Travel Report.